Monster Man, Special Episode, Vason.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer Damien. If you'd like to be like Damien and get your own special episode on a topic of your choosing, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, in addition to your own special episode, you'll also get the rewards for all lower levels, including monthly bonus content and all new episodes of my other podcast, Patron Deities. Today, Damien has asked me to talk about creatures from the role-playing game Vason. So Damien, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoy the show. So if you're not familiar with Vason, it is a game of, quote, Nordic horror role-playing, close quotes. It's published by the fine folks at Free League. It's based on the book Vason by Johan Egerkrans, and I'm sorry, I'm probably going to be making a terrible mess of these Swedish names, and I apologize. It's illustrated by the same artist. The lead writer was Nils Hintze, the game director Nils Carlson, and the editors Thomas Herrenstrom and Matthias Jonsson Hauke. And I apologize for those names. Not for the names, but for my pronunciation of them. So, Nordic horror role-playing. What does that mean? It is a game, in many ways, of folk horror, or at least folk monster hunting. And, you know, I actually don't own this game. I was able to borrow a copy for today's episode. Kind of tempted now, I gotta be honest. Structurally, it resembles, like, Call of Cthulhu or, like, a Monster of the Week game more than a traditional fantasy adventure game. So each creature in this is basically a case. As these kinds of 19th century monster hunters, you're going to be hearing about something strange that's gone on, going to that place, figuring out what kind of monster it is, figuring out how to solve the problem, because often it's not a case of just like getting into a fight with the creature, but you need to figure out what it is that has to be done to end the trouble that it's causing. So the monsters here are very much the focus. They are not just obstacles on the path to some other goal. If you're playing D&D and we take out the monsters, then hey, nothing between you and the treasure except maybe some traps. But in Vason, the monsters are the point. And that means that what we're going to get here is a somewhat different presentation of monsters, where we get quite detailed presentation of a relatively small number of monsters. But because each of those monsters is effectively a scenario, indeed they have kind of like multiple hooks for scenarios in each of them, they're going to be in a little bit more detail. So the name of the game, Vason, again, I may be mispronouncing that. I listened to some recordings of people saying it, though I do believe they were saying it in Danish. If I pull the Rutledge Swedish Dictionary off of the shelf next to my, as silly as a recording studio, my desk where my microphone is, we can see that this is a word with multiple definitions. So the first is simply being. And I think that that's really what the meaning is here, right? Creatures. And it's used in phrases that can mean like a supernatural creature, but also that just mean like a being. So for example, like if you said like, oh, there's no one around, the Swedish equivalent to the English expression, there's not a living soul, you know, would be that word, Vason. It can also mean like the essential nature of something. So like, what is its being? What is its essence? And apparently can also mean like a fuss, you know, a racket, a hullabaloo. And I just realized while I was reading this, you know, because I never really thought about the pronunciation, that of course, if you've ever watched the TV show Grimm, which is about being a monster hunter hunting creatures from German folklore, they use that term, Vason, which I imagine comes from the same root. The core rulebook contains 21 Vason, including many creatures that we have covered before, and even creatures we've done special episodes on, like the Lindorm, giants, ghosts. We may have done sea serpents as well, and I have picked, kind of haphazardly, two of these to cover. As an aside, one of the things that's really great about each of these monster entries is the beautiful art. You know, I like that kind of slightly, it's fairy tale-ish. It's got an aspect of cartoonishness to it that makes it feel somewhere between like a comic book and a children's book. As you know, if you listen to the main Monster Man podcast, we're currently talking about Monstrous Manual from 1993, and one of the things that I compliment about that book is the wonderful art of Tony DiTerlizzi. And this, I feel like, has a similar quality, not in terms that they look alike, but that there is, although, I mean, I think there may be some influence there, but they both have this sort of quality of whimsy to them. So when I looked at the credits page and learned that this game was based on the art of a single artist, the aforementioned Johan Egerkrans, that made sense to me. You know, I think this kind of artistic unity is particularly important to this game, because this is a setting that is neither exactly specific, like a strictly historical game, nor completely generic, like a typical fantasy game. Even when you look at, you know, it's got this particular 19th century Scandinavian aesthetic that I only know a little about because that period of Scandinavian history is an important era for the study of folklore, and for a kind of like popular romantic interest in Old Norse literature and Norse legend in this era of an attempt to create an aesthetic of Scandinavian national identities. So I've read some stuff from this period and, you know, seen a lot of art from this period. It rings a bell for me, you know. I went to the Norwegian Folk Museum and a fella played a hurdy-gurdy for me. It wasn't actually a hurdy-gurdy. I can't remember the name of the instrument. I want to say it looked like a violin with keys, and I asked him the name and he told me, and I seem to remember that it translates to, like, key fiddle. Anyway, I asked this guy, what is this fiddle thing? And he proceeded to bust out, like, a 5-minute virtuoso solo on it, which I thought was, you know, very cool, but had not anticipated that I would just get my own little concert right then and there. Anyway, I guess if you're ever in Oslo, and you have some time left over after going to the Viking Ship Museum, you should go to the Norwegian Folk Museum. But I think that, like most Anglophone readers, I don't instantly go, oh yeah, right, Scandinavia in the 19th century. And this type of artistic unity is therefore really important for a game that rests a lot on, dare I say it, vibes. So, with that quick introduction out of the way, and hopefully it'll be a lot quicker once I've edited it, let's take a look at the creatures themselves. So I'm going to take a look at two. One that does have an equivalent in monsters that we have looked at already on the show, and one that doesn't. So let's start with the one that does. This is the Neck. Now, we haven't done a monster, I don't think, that has the name the Neck, but this river-dwelling musical creature has clear similarities to several monsters that we've looked at. Name-wise, the Neck is kin to the Nixie, and the detail that this monster plays the fiddle will put us in mind of the Fossagrim. Fossagrim is a creature that is, in D&D, inexplicably in the Norse mythology section of Deities and Demigods, despite the fact that he is not a creature from Norse mythology at all. He's a creature from Scandinavian folklore. We have covered the Fossagrim on Patron Deities, covered the Nixie on Monster Man, and of course the Nixie is one of a whole genre of water's edge monsters, right? They are creatures that live in lakes or streams, and they create a hazard, basically. They, in this case, he plays enchanting music that can cause people to dance uncontrollably and then, like, lures them into the river where they drown. Now, there are some versions of the story in which he's just trying to, like, just wants to drown people. He's a drowny guy. And there are other versions of the story in which, because he can live underwater, he just doesn't understand that ordinary people can't. And so they just, like, they get too excited about their dancing and they fall in. And this is a sort of like cautionary tale folklore monster, right? It's like parents warning children not to play too close to the water's edge because the Nixie will get you. Because the actual concern is because you'll fall in. These can sometimes take pretty extreme forms. The one that I keep coming back to is La Llorona, who is a water's edge monster from Mexico and the southwestern United States, and has this whole tragic ghost backstory, but the gist of which is stay away from the edges of, like, canals and drainage ditches. Anyway, as I mentioned, he can enchant people to dance uncontrollably. Like the Fossagrim, he also teaches people to play the fiddle. So if you give him a specific gift, with the Fossagrim, I think it was like sausages or something like that. It was something very everyday, but here it's a black cat, which is pretty grim. And of course, evokes the idea of like a witch's bargain, but on a much smaller scale. He will teach you to play the same kind of haunting melodies that he can play. That's a motif that appears in a lot of folk tales. The one that I always think of is the great blues guitarist Robert Johnson and the legend that he you know, sold his soul to the devil in exchange for being such a great guitar player. I briefly want to mention this, and we'll come back to it in our next monster, but I love the fact that the stakes of the bargain are very small. You give him a small gift. I mean, I hope he loves that cat and keeps it as a pet rather than the obvious, but you give him a small gift, and in exchange, he teaches you to be great at the fiddle. And what that makes me envision is a kind of community, you know, small town or village kind of world where being the best fiddle player in town would be a huge social advantage. In an age prior to the reliable amplification of recorded music, being a musician was like a social necessity. If people wanted to dance, somebody had to play the music. And if you were a fancy person, then that meant hiring professional musicians. And if you weren't, then that meant like knowing who's the best fiddle player in town. But what that means is that if you're the best fiddle player in town, then you get invited to all the dances. So I love that idea of getting some kind of like supernatural backing for something that in many ways kind of low stakes. But it's not low stakes to the person whose life it would change. And it's certainly not low stakes to the people that fall in the river and drown. We get a list of folk remedies that you can use to deal with the neck. So for instance, they're repelled by Christian symbols. They're repelled by steel, again, which doesn't sound like that big of a deal until you think, well, actually, we're living in a world of wood and brick and clay and cloth, where they're like farm tools and things will have steel blades. And, you know, they'll have like a razor or something like that, but there won't be whole buildings that just have their frames made of steel or anything like that, like there are in the modern day, or at least they won't be very common. I don't really know when steel frame building begins, but my guess would be that most villages in, you know, rural Scandinavia in the 19th century did not have it, right? And we also learn that the neck is attracted to the sounds of music and singing and dancing. So we can begin to envision a kind of step-by-step investigative structure for a scenario where first, you know, we find out that someone has gone missing, and then we go to the town, we find that someone's a suspiciously good fiddler, and then we realize that the neck is like on some island in the river, and then we have to like go talk to a bunch of old grandmas to find out what he's afraid of. And then we have to like stage a big dance in the village to lure him into the trap, right? Like he's going to hear the music and dancing and want to come. And then we can surround him with religious symbols, and we'll put all the scythe blades, or we'll like claim that we're doing a sword dance, and we'll, you know, put the swords in a ring or something like that. And then we'll trap him, and that is what banishes him. You know, that sounds like a scenario, right? That sounds like an adventure. Again, the scenario hooks are weird incidents rather than that kind of like, rather than starting with the monster's premise, because finding the monster is part of the fun. Okay, next up we have the Spertus. Now, the Spertus is a little worm-like creature that a person sort of, I mean, I don't even know if they necessarily make an explicit bargain with it, but basically that's what happens. Sort of like a familiar or an imp, and it is very small. It can live in a snuff box, which again puts you right in that 19th century milieu where people have snuff boxes rather than, I don't know, match boxes. Nice. And it doesn't really have any powers itself, but it grants powers to its owner. If you've read the novel Harbor, which is by the same author who wrote Let the Right One In, John Ivid? I don't know if that's how you pronounce it, but anyway, Lindquist. There is a Spertus in that, although he uses Spiritus, right? So Spertus, I guess, is just a way of saying Spiritus. So it's a spirit, but it's in the form of like a little worm or a little insect, and it lives in a snuff box. One of the powers that it is traditionally said to give is the ability to just like produce silver coins. You just reach into your snuff box and pull out a coin, and you can just keep doing this. Like it would seem like you actually have coins in your purse, but actually you've just got a little worm, and every time you reach in there, it somehow comes out with a coin. And again, this is a good example of like, what are the stakes here? Because we're in a world where the ability to just pull out, like, it's not gold coins, right? It's not banknotes. It's just little silver coins. But we're in a world where the ability to just not have to worry about paying for my drinks or my tobacco, or, you know, whether to tip the barber, that makes me a pretty big deal. Enough that we can imagine someone considering selling their soul to the devil for it. It sort of makes me think of Crime and Punishment. Like, if you've read Crime and Punishment, one of the things about it is that after the eponymous crime, but before the titular punishment. The book carefully details all the things that the stolen money is spent on. And it's this very kind of mundane, you know, oh, well, I spent this much on bread and I spent this much on whatever. And you kind of like see how petty it is. You know, how actually, like, it seems like a huge solution to this guy's problems, but from the standpoint of the reader, it's not an enormous amount of money. Or a little bit like the sort of detailed stuff about expenses and expenditure in something like Down and Out in Paris and London. Anyway, so doesn't seem like a big deal to you and me, but again, I think if you're a person in, you know, the 19th century and you have like had to walk around thinking about like, well, if I go into the butcher, is there going to be a scene where he refuses to give me credit in front of my neighbors? I think that there's a lot of people who, given the choice between having to be humiliatingly refused sausages in front of their neighbors and selling their souls to the devil, would sell their souls to the devil. So, the other part of the Spertus' gimmick is that there are a very small number of ways to get rid of it. So you can A, repent and devote your life to piety and good works. B, do a big blood ritual in which you sacrifice a bunch of people, basically like, you know, buying out your contract. Or C, and this is the great thing, pass it on to someone else. But you might think, like, I got away with this scot-free. You know, I went fishing with a human leg on the end of a string, and I fished up this weird insect, and I kept it in a snuff box, and it gave me silver coins, and, you know, I bought drinks for the house and felt like a big shot, and I started to worry that it was endangering me, and I gave it to my cousin, and now he's a sorcerer, I guess, but it's not my problem anymore. You think you're doing pretty good, and maybe you are, but the giving it away thing only works so many times. In fact, it's actually what the Spertus wants. Because on the third owner, the Spertus takes over. I think that's great. I mean, obviously three, nice folkloric sounding number. But also, it means that the creature generates a kind of scenario trail of clues. So you'd be investigating all these weird happenings, and then you would kind of come up with like multiple suspects and then realize that it was actually all of them, but also not any of them, that the creature is separate from them. Terrific. Love it. And you kind of follow this little chain of people to eventually confront the third owner. Very simple and straightforward. So the thing that both of these share and the thing that I like about them is their small scale. You could absolutely have a Spertus that would grant people like great power, you know, mind control, invisibility, you know, vast wealth. But the way in which the Spertus kind of reveals, maybe the word I'm looking for is pettiness, I think is really appealing. And I would love to, you know, I think if you're going to translate that monster into another game, I'd love to keep that scale. I've talked before about wanting to run a kind of village hero scale D&D game. I'm not going to because there's only so many hours in the day. But I think it could be fun, and I think the Spertus would be a great thing to put in there because it's like physically not a threat, just like a little bug, but what it does is turn people into these kinds of local villains. You know, the whole reason that you're investigating this thing is that these people are like your neighbors. You don't want to just go and like rough up your best friend's uncle just because he happens to have sold his soul to the devil and now he's got a snuff box full of coins. So you have to kind of think your way around the problem. And it works well if you have it on that kind of like persistent village scale, because it's a monster that's about the personality flaws of your local village characters. So if you're in the same place over a long period of time, you would get to know those NPCs, and then you might be able to see those sorts of changes in their behavior and things like that. So I think it fits that type of setting really well. So even if I were going to take these creatures, I mean, again, the idea of like a diabolical familiar is not a new one, but if I were going to take these creatures, I'd love to see them kept at that same level. Like the neck just wants to dance and play music and have a good time. It's lonely on its island, and it's very sorry that the people it keeps trying to lure to its island drown, but it's really your own fault for not breathing water. The Spertus doesn't seem immediately to have a whole lot of negative effects, but it has this sort of escalation mechanic built into it that I didn't talk about. But, you know, once you get to that third owner, the further you get up the chain, the more obvious the magical aspects become. That's pretty cool. And again, the idea that somebody who's a little bit of an enchanter can have a big effect on this relatively low magic, like kind of small scale world, I don't know. I really like it. So obviously monsters that come from folklore are a big thing of mine. Yeah. You know, my own contributions to a folklore bestiary are, should be out any day now. I believe backers already have their PDFs. One of the biggest challenges that we face using these creatures in role-playing games is how to turn the small scale interactions that most folklore monsters have. Like, consider something like the Bacan, a creature from Scottish folklore that like can turn into a goat and goes around doing things like challenging drunk farmers to fist fights as they make their way home from the pub. How do you take that and put it into the sort of typical heroic fantasy context of a typical role-playing game? And what Vaesen does is it doesn't do that, but it has the PCs kind of be outsiders. So there's sort of this idea in Vaesen that 19th century Scandinavia is undergoing this profound social transformation. I mean, and you know, as is Europe in general, but specifically that the characters who are representatives of this, you know, sort of more quote-unquote modern, more quote-unquote sophisticated sort of post-Enlightenment culture are almost as much, you know, even though they themselves are Swedish or Norwegian or whatever, they are outsiders in the traditional culture that they're investigating. And that means that the PCs are a little more connected to the players because, like the players, they're a little bit on the outside of that culture, but they have a little bit of an in. They're not completely tourists, but they are separated. So it's sort of taken what it perceives as a social division that existed within that society and turned it into something that makes the game more approachable for players, because playing in that kind of historical setting often makes people go, oh, but I don't know enough about it. And here you can say, oh, well, also your characters don't know that much about it, without having them be time travelers or something, which I think is quite clever. All right, so that's what I got to say about Vaesen. It's going on my shopping list, I guess. There's a British one as well, which I should also check out, I suppose. That might be more my speed, but also more familiar, which maybe is not what I'm looking for. But Damien, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Everyone else, remember that if you'd like to be like Damien and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. In our next episode, we'll be returning to Monstrous Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition. And after that, we've got a listener request special on mechanical monsters coming up. So I hope that you will join me for both of those, right here on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.